Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. Live, online, smartphones, DSTV, and 92.7. And 106
FM. Didn't we see that several airlines have grounded the Boeing 737 MAX 8 jet that they've got in their fleets following that fatal Ethiopian Airlines crash at the weekend? 157 people died. The only airline in South Africa to fly the same model is Comair, and they've got one of these aircraft with more on order. Now, Comair today is saying it'll continue to fly that aircraft unless the evidence emerges that it's dangerous to do so. The 737 MAX 8, it says, one of the most commonly used aircraft in the world today. There are 330 of these in operation globally. But the Ethiopian crash does come less than 6 months after the same model aircraft, the 737 MAX 8, it's called, operated by Lion Air in Indonesia, crashed in October last year. So naturally, it leads to all kinds of panic. And people have been coming up to me today and saying, oh, you're not going to be flying on this aeroplane, are you? And I got a list from somebody saying that this airline, the following list of airlines fly this particular model of aircraft. Oh, is this an overreaction? I wonder. I don't know. Would you be comfortable flying on the 737 MAX 8 jet? Yes, breaking news. Comair, I see, on ENCA this evening. Comair has actually grounded the 737 MAX 8 jet. They've refused to talk today. Please, Lefifi, Tikiso, Anthony, let us try and get hold of Renelle Stunder at Comair and find out what has changed their mind. They've now joined, it would seem, a legion of other airlines in grounding this aircraft. If not, let's talk to an expert, please, as to what now the sudden panic about the 737 MAX 8. Is it justified?
702. Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
And he's written a note on my screen. Noted. Excellent. Now dial. APSA is still on the lookout for a new chief executive to replace Maria Ramos, who retired last month without a full-time successor being appointed. The bank has an acting chief executive in the form of the former registrar of banks, René van Wyk, not expecting to have a new boss this year, possibly in place by this time next year. Jason Quinn is the finance director at APSA on the line to us from Johannesburg. Is it disruptive, Jason, to not have a full-time boss?
Well, I'll tell you what, Bruce, it certainly doesn't change the workload. We've been very busy. We've got a new strategy. We're trying to get our growth back. We're dealing with the separation, so no, we're very focused.
I mean, yeah, you've got a new strategy. You're dealing with the separation. The separation you could do nothing about. But now the strategy is a strategy defined by a management team led by Maria Ramos, who is now gone. And now you've got an acting chief executive who's implementing the strategy that could be a different strategy by the time a new boss arrives. That's the point of the question as to about disruption with the sort of hiatus between full-time leaders.
Well, thanks, Bruce. Look, we certainly have a new strategy. The board and the leadership team around Maria have been pretty stable. We went through the retail and business banking strategy refresh last year. We've got CRB underway at the moment. You also heard us talk today about the successes we're starting to see and the green shoots we're building, momentum building in our lending books and deposit books in South Africa and across the continent. So, yeah, look, we miss Maria, but we're certainly very focused on the plans that have been set, and we're executing against those.
If there's a problem, child, it is the corporate and investment bank. I mean, the results out of that were probably the weakest across the group.
I think if you look at underlying performance in CIB, Bruce, you would see that there was a particularly large single name impairment in that business.
If it was wasn't that the Steinhoff write-off?
Well, we're not using a name, but it's not that one. It's also
another one. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. There we are. Stutterfords, or was it the cost of taking equity in Edgar's? I mean, there are lots of choices, I suppose.
Yeah. So there was one of those. It was a debt exposure that we fully dealt with now. If it wasn't for that, our underlying performance in CIB was actually better than it looks. The revenue performance there was pretty strong. And so there's nice momentum building in that business across the continent, because it's actually not just a South African business anymore. We really have diversification. We've got strong growth there in Ghana, Kenya, Botswana, Zambia as well.
I mean, one looks at these Africa strategies that Standard Bank has embarked on, that you've embarked on, that Old Mutual has embarked on, and so far we're yet to see, of course, the rewards coming through. But I'm not sure if you've seen a copy of The Economist this week talking about this embassy building frenzy across Africa, saying foreign governments and businesses are rushing into Africa, and this time the winners could be Africans themselves. Between 2010 and 2016, more than 320 embassies were built across Africa, probably the biggest embassy building boom anywhere ever. I mean, is that what you are preparing for, the sort of embassy-led economic boom for this continent, the last sort of place on earth where a boom perhaps is due?
You know, Bruce, in our circumstances, it was particularly useful to be able to buy off Barclays their businesses across the continent in 2013. And the reason that was helpful, they were established businesses. They had systems and controls, technologies that we were used to. So that was the kind of cornerstone of the initial parts of that strategy. You know, of course, when we bought them, the return on equity was sitting in the mid-12s, and we were very pleased to get that to just under 19% return on equity in these results we just reported. So it is a growth strategy, but it's certainly balanced with returns to shareholders.
That 3.2 billion rand separation costs, one of the reasons put forward to a drop in profit in the last year. I thought Barclays was liable for some pretty hefty fees for the breakup. I mean, if this is what it costs to get divorced, it's the best warning ever. Don't ever get divorced, because you picked up a big part of that separation cost.
Well, Bruce, let me just clarify that. So I think you're referring to our IFRS headline earnings, which was down one, as you say. Our normalized headline earnings per share, which excludes the effects of separation, which we believe is a better indication of the underlying performance of the company, was up 4 on a HEPS basis, which aligned to our dividend of 4. So when you look at it, I suppose the separation in the first instance, when we step back, it was actually an inflection point for our company. It created the opportunity to build a new strategy, to refresh the culture of the organization and the like. So it's got all of those positives to it. They also contributed 12.6 billion rand at the time of separation. So the 3.2 billion that you referred to was funded by that 12.6. The separation is progressing well, which was another headline today.
And I mean, they've got less than 15% in the group. At one stage, I thought they were going to hold up to 20%. I mean, is this them slowly whittling down their holding all together in APSA? Is that their plan? Have they sort of spoken out about that?
Bruce, you'd have to ask them with respect to their intention at 15%. They are shareholders at 15%, as you say. While the effects of separation are material, they can't sell down much further. The way our attitude as a board to our stock would be that we see ourselves as pretty much free float. So I think they would have that opportunity down the line. They have to hold it at the moment. I think in their books, you know, given the fact that they've deconsolidated us and they don't have to hold all the extra capital that they used to, the return on the investment that they earn in our business is actually quite superior to many of the other businesses at the moment. So I don't think they'd be rushing to sell. But that's certainly a question you should ask them.
Yeah, the South African economy under a huge amount of pressure. I mean, there's no question about that. You're showing signs of being willing to lend a little bit more into an economy that might get past 1% growth this year, might not, we'll see. One wonders just what the outlook is for this economy and just how much of a bet you can take on a sustained turnaround.
Yeah, Bruce, when we guided today in terms of outlook for this year, we did caution a little bit with respect to the first half of this year. Financial markets have started particularly slowly. We've seen lower volumes in our fixed income, currency, commodity trading businesses and the like. So, a little bit cautious around outlook in the South African economy, but that's not to say that there aren't opportunities for growth. And we've certainly been able to identify and execute against that already in the second part of last year.
Jason Quinn, the Finance Director at APSA, thank you very much for coming through for us this evening. Chief Executive, or the Acting Chief Executive there, the former Registrar of Banks, René van Wyk, who'd been previously an executive at Nedbank, so he's got his scars from his time in the banking sector. APSA, as far as I can tell, still out in the market looking for a new Chief Executive. They may have identified one or two people they think would be up for the job, but they haven't yet shared with us who those people might be. In a moment, Peter Brook with our wrap-up of today's markets. Tongaat Hewlett, another 20% down today. That's a scary drop, but nothing as scary as Aspen Pharmacare's 50% slump on Friday. Eventually ended down about 30%, and today there was a small recovery in Aspen. But lots of results today as well. Amongst those, APSA, you've just heard, of course, the finance director at APSA, Jason Quinn, but we also had Old Mutual out today, AVI, and a couple of others.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Peter Brook with the Old Mutual Investment Group. He is our market commentator this evening. KZN Company is letting down the world. I mean, Tongaat's actually quite scary. I mean, there seems to be a real fear that this is not a business that will survive, Peter Brook.
It's a really toxic mix if you think about
you've got an accounting issue, which has been declared up, and you've got a debt problem. So when people immediately go, Steinhoff, lost all of our money,
stay away.
Can't touch this.
Yeah.
And that's what happened with Aspen, which is, I mean, for such a large company to drop 50% in today and then finish and then to rebound, it just shows you how that Steinhoff effect is still carrying on. And one of the critical things to look at is the market capitalization of a company relative to its debt. And what's happened is that as you tip through that, you suddenly get a situation where equity holders are less than the debt holders, and that's when the fear of sort of forced rights issues or deeply discounted rights issues eroding your capital.
So Tongaat finds itself there. Will Aspen find itself there as well? I mean, they're talking about selling off businesses and slimlining the business, and they've taken a piece of elastic and they've expanded in, what, 50, 60 countries around the world. They've got points of presence, and they've tell a great story about it. But in order to do that, they borrowed an extraordinary amount of money to go and buy these businesses whose cash flows aren't meeting projections, and therefore they're struggling to service that huge debt.
Well, yesterday in the Sunday Times, there was the headline, is Aspen the new Steinhoff? And
that's is that fair in terms of, I mean, Steinhoff is a fraud. And, I mean, there's a 2,500 or 3,000 page PwC report, which has apparently been sent to Steinhoff to say, this is what happened in your company. What PwC believes happens in the company. Would you care to comment before we publish? Is Aspen in the same boat?
I don't think so. So that headline made me want to go and buy some shares.
Ah, okay.
And it's interesting because Aspen didn't own it at 400, didn't own it to 250, but at 140 Rand, it starts becoming interesting.
At 100 bucks.
At 100 bucks. Now it's more interesting. Ooh. So the critical thing is, what level of cash flow can it produce? And it does produce good cash. The real issue is just the size of the debt. You know, you're talking 57 billion Rand. This isn't something you can easily write a check for.
No.
And while there's credibility question marks around when does this deal come through? Is the cash going to come through? Because that's a massive sale.
The deal you're talking about is the 10 billion Rand infant milk formula deal. They announced that months and months and months and months ago, but it's dragging through.
So there's one outstanding, which is the New Zealand government allowing the buyer, Lactalis, to do the transaction. If that goes through, that will take away a lot of that risk. But it's not just that, because the issue was the cash conversion of those earnings in the first half. So I don't think it's Steinhoff. I don't think there's a corporate fraud. But the critical word is trust.
Yep.
So when you look at this, do you trust the auditors? Do you trust the management? And what Steinhoff has done, and in politics we've had the same issue,
sure,
is we've destroyed trust.
Absolutely.
And when that happens, you pay a there's a cost. And what happens is the premium that you're prepared to pay decreases. And so that's the issue.
I see that you've got with you, I don't know if you've read it yet, the article in The Economist, the one that talks about this embassy building frenzy. I hope The Economist is right, because they tend to get the cycles exactly wrong. Africa rising, Africa fading, or whatever headlines they've had in the past. This one's a bit more creative, this new scramble for Africa, this boom in building of embassies, 300 and something embassies over 7 years, the fastest and most incredible building frenzy ever in building embassies, implying that countries are positioning themselves on this continent for growth.
So there's two elements. One is, in a multipolar world, which is what we're moving towards, there is going to be, Africa's the one area that's sort of free in this whole land grab. And so I think there will be a lot of interest, and I think already you can see the center of gravity is shifting east.
Yeah.
And it's not just us. I don't know if you know, but the right-wing government in Italy is also shifting east. So because Trump is creating a power vacuum, it will be resolved, and I think we'll see a lot of that. I think the other element is the cover effect, which is broadly you should do the opposite. So when you have a chief executive who's amazing, you should sell the share, and when you have somebody saying this is a disaster, you should look at buying it. That's why Aspen, it was all good news. That was your signal to sell. Now it's all bad news. You should be looking at it. This cover, in my analysis, it's not telling you anything. wouldn't read too much into it.
Okay, good. Thank you for putting that to bed. APSA results, not impressive. Old Mutual results, not impressive. AVI, good for biscuits, not so good for expensive shoes. I mean, give me a broad overview of how you see this actually plethora of results today.
Basically, everyone was negative. So APSA is trying to cut it a different way, but that's minus one. Old Mutual's minus 11. RMI is negative in it. That's a good proxy because they've got Discovery minus 16, Hastings minus 9, Outsurance minus 8. They own lots of different assets. AVI minus 6. So bottom line is earnings negative. Almost across the board, sort of low turnover growth, low nominal GDP, very good cost control, but still not good enough, leading to a little... These, in aggregate, they're not great results, but if you look at the environment, these aren't bad to do... To do minus 5, say, in an environment where your costs are going up and your revenue's not growing, it's okay.
None of these results should be a surprise, considering the first half of last year we were in recession. The economy shrank and we didn't exactly bounce back with any great degree of vigor or conviction in the second half of last year.
No, absolutely not. I don't think they are a surprise, and that's why you can see the market reaction. So often what we're seeing is... company produces bad results and actually we get a little bit of up. It's all about the relative expectation.
At what point is this market and companies that have been battered down 50, 60, 70, 80% in some cases, the biggest sitting duck waiting to be poached in the world?
It's getting closer. So the real issue was 3 years ago, we were really expensive.
Yeah.
And since then, our expected real returns have been picking up, and now we're actually starting to get interesting. What's important is that the price that you pay, the multiple or the price earnings, is down, but also the earnings base is down, which means that if we get a little bit of growth and we get some operating leverage, you can get a rebound in earnings and you can get a rebound in PE. I think to do that, we probably need GDP growth around 3%.
Oh, dear.
And we're not there yet.
No.
So... that's why these elections are important. The trend, I think, is gently up, which creates a better base. But now it's not good enough yet that you can go and mortgage your house. But you can certainly be sniffing around looking for opportunities in some of these companies that have fallen so much that actually you do have fundamental value.
Peter Brook with the Old Mutual Investment Group.
The Money Show is brought to you by Nedbank. Looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently. Nedbank.
We'll do sport in just a minute and catch up with Guy Leach. Thank you, Tiki. So well done. Guy Leach is the guy from SA Flyer magazine. I just want to talk about this Comair, which seems to have also joined the number of airlines worldwide, which have pulled the plug on operating the 737-800 MAX, the particular aircraft involved in the Ethiopian air crash, tragic crash over the weekend. 157 people were killed over the weekend, and it's on the heels of a crash in Indonesia, which also claimed lives about 6 months ago. So there is widespread concern, and Comair initially had been quite resolute in the fact that they would continue to fly the aircraft, and they've only got one until they'd spoken to Boeing. But now they say, oh, okay, fine, we'll suspend flights in this particular aircraft until we've spoken to Boeing, which is the more measured approach to that. On the next Money Show, we're looking at the workings of producing tequila locally, except you can't call it tequila, a bit like port and sherry and things like that. You need to come up with a local name. Agave is what Martin van Duspera, an academic behind Agave, is calling it. It's a distillery in Graaf Reinet. Now, how it works feature. Also, results from First Rand and Andy Rice with this week's advertising heroes and zeros, with a bit of politics chucked into the mix.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. Live, online, smartphones, DSTV, and 92.7 and 106 FM.
Okay, thanks very much. It's touch base with Guy Leach very quickly, the managing editor at SA Flyer magazine. Guy Leach, Comair announcing this evening that they are joining a couple of airlines around the world and suspending flights of the 737-800 aircraft, the same model that was involved in this, the 737-800 MAX, the one involved involved in the Ethiopian Airlines disaster over the weekend and the same one involved in a crash in Jakarta 6 months ago. Are they doing the right thing here, Guy Leach, or are they overreacting?
Yeah, good evening, Bruce. I'm very pleased to hear this. I was just actually telling Eric Fenter earlier that I disagreed with him for continuing to fly the aircraft. It was clearly putting profit over safety of people. And they just had one in the fleet. So I believe it was possible for them to ground it. It makes sense to ground it while at least they don't know what's caused the Ethiopian crash. There are marked similarities with the Jakarta crash. But that's all the more reason to be cautious, because if Boeing hadn't sorted out the bug after the Jakarta crash, then it makes a lot of sense to keep the aeroplane on the ground until they know more about what's happened to it.
The bug you refer to is a software concern. I mean, modern aircraft fly flown by computers. Occasionally, they allow the pilot to intervene. I mean, there is a concern that there may be something wrong with the computers on these planes.
Yeah, it's perhaps not so much the computers as the information they receive, the good old figure, garbage in and garbage out. All of these, let's call them flight management computers, require information from various sources, from angle of attack indicators or from pitot-head sensors to sense airspeed and obviously from altimeters and so on. And if any of that information is bad or defective, then it can confuse the computer. That's pretty much what is understood to have happened for the Lion Air flight, and the similarities, as I said, with the Ethiopian flight are marked, so it could well have happened again to this particular flight.
Yeah, I mean, and the decision, again, there's only one of these aircraft. It is from our research, and we had Business Unusual correspondent Colin Cullis researching this. It was scheduled only to fly on Wednesday this week. It doesn't cause havoc. Does it cause havoc within their schedules at all?
No, I don't think it does. I mean, the aircraft only arrived 2 weeks ago. Yes, it's obviously been working. But to the best of my knowledge, Comair hasn't retired any of their existing 737-800s to make way for this new aircraft. So they must have a spare capacity at this particular stage. It's not the high season either right now. It certainly makes a lot of sense to me to keep the aircraft on the ground rather than risk passengers' lives. Because let's face it, if something did happen to this aircraft, it would kill Comair entirely, apart from the 150 or 80 lives that would obviously be taken down with it as well. The risks, quite frankly, are just too great. People say that safety is non-negotiable. I think Comair need to really show that.
And what about Boeing itself? I mean, as a manufacturer of aircraft, as its shares open trade in the United States this morning, they just dropped rapidly, I think down 12% as they opened. I'm not sure where they're trading right now. But Boeing is dealing probably with the biggest reputational crisis of its recent existence.
That's certainly true. I believe the shares have recovered, or the stock has recovered back to about 6% down. It shows the market does have confidence that Boeing will be able to solve this problem. But let's face it, these narrow bodies, the 737 range, it amounts to almost half Boeing's total revenue. So if this aircraft, if there was, for argument's sake, a third event like this, Boeing would be in huge problem. I mean, if it's not already in incredibly big problems right now, with the airlines increasingly moving to ground this fleet of 738s. They're between a rock and a hard place. Certainly there will be class action suits and there will be claims by the airlines against Boeing. To what extent they've got this stuff covered by insurance, I don't know. But I very much doubt whether it's significant.
Guy Leach, thanks for coming through for us this evening. Managing Editor at SA Flyer Magazine, Guy Leach.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. Live, online, smartphones, DSTV, and 92.7. And
holding there for us, Peter Moyo, Old Mutual Group Chief Executive, on the line to us from Johannesburg. A disappointing performance from Old Mutual, Peter. I mean, paint a picture for me, broad brushstrokes, if you would. What does Old Mutual look like on a map of the world right now in its new fighting shape that you've created since spinning off lots of the businesses and delisting from the London Stock Exchange?
Hi, Bruce. The shape of Old Mutual, we operate in 13 African countries. We are in the process of getting out of LATAM, where we're in 3 countries, and we still have our joint venture arrangement in China.
So you got, and so the joint venture arrangement in China, that continues, but you're getting out of Latin America. You're essentially an African insurer.
Yes, an African financial services group, because in some countries we're very, very big. On the banking side, we're probably the number three biggest bank in Zimbabwe. We are in banking in East Africa. And our lending profits are growing in South Africa.
When we look at the structure of Old Mutual, is everything that is sold, everything that needs to be unbundled and sold? I mean, is the business of Old Mutual, is this the core? Is this the base of the, dare I call it, the new Old Mutual?
Yeah, we have actually sold everything that we're meant to sell. We are in the process of shutting down or making sure that we wrap up those operations that we were selling. And we completed the unbundling of NetBank around about October. So we're really operating as we should operate going into the future.
When Moncada was told at the time of these unbundlings and this restructuring that the company would be better off without the massive head office costs in London, for example, the complex global structure. In the cold light of day, and now that the Nedbank unbundling is done, does the thinking that precipitated the restructuring of Old Mutual still hold true?
Oh, yes. It actually holds true, Bruce. Let me just get on how we performed. As part of our listing, we actually made certain commitments. Notwithstanding the drop in our results from operations, we've actually met all our commitments to the investor community. Our return on net asset value is about what we promised. Our dividend is within the cover level that we talked about. Our cost checkout is on track to deliver what we promised. Our short-term insurance business is actually performing at the top end of what we promised the market it will do. It was a pity that we went backwards on our results from operations. We took a big hit on the Zimbabwean side. We actually took a decision to write down the profit in Zimbabwe because of the currency situation. In fact, we led the market on that. The business itself is actually running very, very well. We struggled on our personal finance business in South Africa. We're taking the corrective actions, but already at the half year, we were actually significantly down and running at down 36% in one of the biggest businesses. And we end up with the results from operations. And after taking the kind of write-down that we took in Zimbabwe, down 4%, I really think it's a credible result. I'm comfortable with the management actions that we're taking to manage.
The fact that you're spending 2 billion rand on share buybacks, though, and often when companies do this is because they just don't see growth opportunities elsewhere. I mean, is that the thinking in Old Mutual, that the environment in which you operate is just so non-growth that it's better to buy back your own shares and improve, therefore, the performance per share of the remaining stock?
On the contrary, this actually talks to the capital that we have, again, as part of our listing story. We said we're going to be very efficient with our capital. So if you look at our measures and you not hear us talk about revising that, we say long term, medium to long term, we want to run a company that's actually growing at GDP, at a growth rate of GDP plus 2%. We're still very committed to that. We said we're going to deliver a return on net asset value of average cost of equity plus 4%, which is at 17.4%. We are in that range. So if you put all those together, it actually talks about a company that's growing. But we have capital. We paid a special dividend last year, and we also with the unbundling, so not the sale of LATAM, we expect to have further capital receipts. So yeah, and I mean, if you look at what we're doing on the IT front and the developments that we have, I'm very, very excited about what we're doing. So it's not a company that's actually shrinking itself to growth. On the contrary, we are actually growing. And
Peter Moyo, we must leave it there. Apologies for cutting you. Peter Moyo, Chief Executive of Old Mutual.
The Money Show. Stock Pick Monday.
Time to look at some companies in this very, very difficult investing environment that you might be brave enough to invest in. And boy, talk about bravery. Razin Dinat is the head of research at KD's Asset Management. And Razin, Mediclinic, what is it? Angels go where fools go where angels fear to tread. You're not feeling foolish or you're feeling angelic? Mediclinic has been battered.
Yes, Bruce. So we look for companies that are suffering from what we think is temporary problems. And with Mediclinic, sorry about my voice. With Mediclinic,
okay.
We found that the business has been suffering from regulatory issues in Switzerland, which has caused the earnings to fall slightly. And management was caught off guard in terms of that the changes came into place much faster than they could react. So they've changed the CEO in the business, and what gives us confidence they can turn the situation around is that they've had a similar issue in the Middle East, and that's definitely on the right trajectory. So we think that there is problems, but it's solvable, and you know the share price has come down so much that it's definitely very attractively priced.
Okay, well, that's good news because, I mean, so many investors have been so badly burned by Mediclinic with its global expansion, so many investors in companies that expanded. I mean, Famous Brands came out with a trading update very late this afternoon. I mean, talking about the 24 gourmet burger kitchen stores closed during the period in the UK. I mean, they're doing a massive cleanup of their own mistakes as they expanded, and Mediclinic has had to do the same. MultiChoice is an interesting company. I mean, it's a brand new listing on the JSE, spun off out of NUSP. And it made a very unexciting debut last week, but has gradually been growing. And what, today at 112 Rand a share, it's beginning to show some signs of potential.
Yes, so, you know, with these spin-offs, there's usually quite a large overhang of shareholders who get something out of a bigger group which they don't really value or which they don't actually want exposure to. So what tends to happen is there's quite a lot of selling pressure initially, and the share price goes down quite a lot. So we saw it list at what we thought was quite a low level, and it went down to just over 90 Rand a share. The business is a good business in terms of it's actually one of the few pay TV companies in the world that's actually growing subscribers. Even in South Africa, in this tough environment, they're still growing subscribers by 7 to 8%. Africa has huge growth potential, but the African business has been hit hard by currency devaluation in Nigeria and Angola. So you've got a business in South Africa that makes 10 billion rand of trading profit, and it's subsidizing 4 billion rand of losses in Africa. So if you separate the two and you look at it as, you know, a business that is still growing and has lots of potential and is being funded at a low point in its capacity utilization, this is a very stable, mature business that generates good, strong free cash flow. That there's quite a lot of underlying value in the business, and it's quite a strong business and has good competitive advantages, especially in Africa and South Africa.
And the market seems to be supporting your story very strongly. Finally, Walgreen Boots. I mean, Walgreen's one of the biggest pharmacy businesses in the United States. Boots, the biggest in the United Kingdom. Why do you like this one? I mean, this is for only those who've got the ability to take some money out the country, of course, and invest on international exchanges. But tell us the tale there.
So Walgreen Boots is also a company that, you know, has been under quite a bit of share price pressure. The earnings have disappointed. There's been a lot of news and news flow about Amazon starting a pharmacy business. And, you know, there's a lot of negativity towards the brick-and-mortar retailers. So what we've found is that the whole sector that's, you know, selling the old sort of retail business model, all the companies in that industry and sector has been quite badly beaten up. And Walgreen Boots is actually a very solid business with a very defensive, you know, product that they sell. So most of the products that they sell is the pharmaceutical drugs. with 25% of their products being what they call front office, which is your beauty products and stuff like that, where they make quite good profits. So earnings have been under pressure, hasn't been growing as strongly as in the past, and, you know, there's quite a lot of negativity there. So it's also a very good company in terms of defensive product, very good long-term track record, and trading at 10 times earnings versus the Clicks in South Africa, which is trading close to 30 times earnings. So the value is definitely more apparent in that sort of sector right now.
Razin, thank you. Razin Dinat, who is the head of research at Cady's Asset Management. Three companies tonight: Mediclinic, MultiChoice, and Walgreen Boots.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702. For the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show, brought to you by Nedbank. Looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently. Nedbank. Tracy Going, our Make Money Monday special edition guest this evening at 7:30. But before that, The Formula. It's a book which claims that you can find out who is going to be more successful than anybody else if you understand the science. It's the science behind why people succeed or fail. And it's been given some very high level texts, most notably from Nassim Taleb, the author of The Black Swan, and saying it's just a really important project to understand who is and who is not going to succeed. Can we put a science to it? Well, the author, Albert Laszlo Barabasi, I beg your pardon, Albert Laszlo Barabasi, maintains that you can. Tonight, two success stories of retailers doing business with small companies, and I'll explain why that's important in just a moment. All of that is coming up in the next hour here on The Money Show.
702. SMS Bruce on 31702.
Well, a very long statement out today from the Banking Association of South Africa claiming that it's ticking multiple boxes in terms of key transformation targets as required by the Financial Sector Charter. There are just too many numbers for us to make head or tail of it on radio, frankly. But the association saying, amongst other things, the areas where they're doing better than is actually required in terms of the Financial Sector Charter include black ownership of banks. They also say that lending for BEE deals has picked up, but admit that lending to small and medium enterprises has dropped, and that's not a good thing. The association admits that it's got a long way to go in terms of transformation of senior management, but it does highlight that 84% of middle management in banks nowadays are made up of black professionals, suggesting that there is growing people within the industry. So you don't have a bank like APSA go, we don't have anybody to make chief executive when Maria retires and she goes, and then you're left with a gap. Interesting also to see where they spend their money. Now, banks in 2017 spent 71 billion rand on procurement, and that's a big spend. More than half of that, interestingly enough, was spent in small businesses and companies with high levels of women ownership and black ownership as well. More and more companies are helping smaller businesses. And unfortunately, whether you like it or not, if you're in a large business and if you're in charge of procurement, there is an obligation on you to diversify the way in which you procure stuff. It's so much easier to get the widgets that you got from the same company for 30 years and you still got a good deal and a good relationship, but the pressure is on you to find new sources of widget providers or service providers. ShopRite today telling us that they've awarded a multi-million rand supply contract to a company called Very Green to supply 25 products under their Right brand. And the person who's going to talk to us about that is the co-founder of Very Green, Tina Mazia. And Tina is on the line to us from Durban this evening. Tina, you've been going since 2001. And you've been making a whole range of drawstring refuse bags for the last 8 years or so. And now you're going to cooking, baking, freezing and food protection products. Essentially what we might refer to broadly as Tupperware. You're making containers and ShopRite's given you a contract for that.
Hi, Bruce. Thank you for having me on your show. Let me just clarify. No, we are a plastic manufacturing company. Based in Durban. So our core lines are drawstring refuse bags, your freezer bags, foil, cling wrap, and baking.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I thought you were making the boxes with the lids and stuff. Okay, fine. No, that's fine. So, I mean, But you're in the plastic bag business. But what's critical about here is that you're not going off and buying your raw materials from the plastic raw material factory. You're getting a lot of your raw material from your own supply chain. And you've gone into communities and to what you call your super mamas to supply you with the raw material you need to manufacture your products.
Yes, we do have a program called Super Mama. It's a program that empowers women through recycling. So we work through previously disadvantaged women. We train them in plastic waste collection, sorting and grading of plastic waste. We then pay them a premium rate for this uncontaminated plastic waste. And we recycle it into our drawstring refuse bags under the Super Mama brand.
But 360 tons of plastic waste a year. I mean, how many people do you have doing this collection for you?
We have over 300 mamas, which have been empowered through the program. So essentially, they are micro entrepreneurs. They are able to feed their families through the waste that they source. And yeah, we pay them on a weekly basis. So the program has made a difference in their lives. Yeah.
And what's the extent of the ShopRite contract? What does this do for you? Because so often, as Pavlo Fortidi is our small business expert on a Thursday night will tell us, is so often a big deal with a large corporate is the one thing everybody in small business dreams about, and then the reality comes in and having to deliver, and suddenly it can cause all kinds of chaos within your own business. Are you geared up for it and ready for it?
Oh, yes, most definitely. Well, let me just take you through our relationship with ShopRite. I mean, when we launched our Supreme brand in 2012, ShopRite was the first major retailer to believe in our brand. And, I mean, in 2017, we received the ShopRite Checkers Supplier of the Year award amongst 23,000 other suppliers. So it's been a long road of proving ourselves, showing that we can manufacture the best product in the market. So recently we've been awarded their house brand and ShopRite business. So it just shows that, you know, they recognize the value we bring to the category through our innovative products. So yeah, we pride ourselves as being a company that is passionate about doing well while doing good. And I think this ShopRite and Right Brand business has been awarded on the back of our commitment to product innovation and being just customer focused. So yeah.
Tina Mazia. Lovely story. Thank you very much for sharing it with us this evening. The co-founder of Very Green, and they've got a contract with ShopRite, and that's great. And then I was interested today to see something from Pick and Pay, something called the Meet the Maker Showcase. They're going to trial this at 8 stores across the country over a 3-month period. Now, I will not claim credit for this, but when Woolworths was in the midst of their chaos around the baby carrier debacle that they forced upon themselves, I did write a column suggesting that precisely what Pick and Pay is doing today should be done by Woolworths, to say sorry, to say, look, you know what, we've made a mistake, we've blundered here, and what we should really be doing is creating space for local suppliers to do it. And what Pick and Pay is doing is that they are creating a platform that will showcase products and tell customers about the business journey of the individual suppliers, and it'll be on a short-term trial basis to see whether or not there is a long-term future in this kind of relationship. Mashinga Kombo is the head of enterprise and supplier development at Pick and Pay, on the line to us from Cape Town. What is the basis of this particular project, Mashinga? I mean, here you're giving a really nice platform. I see Musgrave Gin is in there. There are a whole bunch of brands that you are going to be putting space aside for in 8 stores for them to essentially show themselves off to your customers.
Absolutely. Bruce, thanks so much for having me on the show. But on the back of, I just want to say congratulations to Tina, the previous caller, on her, and I'll steal her term about empowering women. Mm-hmm. Bruce, for us, it's about skills development, job creation, and making sure that we're taking this country forward. I think on the back of your introduction, you know, small businesses, as you rightly said, they have such a battle to climb when supplying any retailer. And what we wanted to do is integrate those products and really say for our customers, here they are, meet some of the incredible people behind some of these brands, and Bruce, support them. Support them by buying local. Support them by putting your money behind these brands so we can keep the lights on and keep creating jobs.
Now, you've chosen a handful of suppliers. I mean, how many altogether?
So we've chosen a handful of suppliers. We've chosen 12 suppliers. And what we've done is, we've, as you've mentioned, we've got Musgrave Gin, we've got Breva, a non-alcoholic beverage, we've got a lovely tortilla wraps. And what we've done is, from that, we have over 100 suppliers. And as we've said, it's about taking those suppliers and putting it at the front of the customer's face, but also looking at the stores, because in the category, as you know, it can be very busy. And a lot of the category has some of the big brands. And what we're trying to say is, hey, guys, look here. This is a supplier around your neighborhood. They're right behind your neighborhood. Support them. We have a beautiful son and father couple who have created Green World Chemicals. And I just want to pause here by talking about how one of the entrepreneurs left his full-time position at Bloomberg to join his father in this business. And they have a fantastic product, which is a fire lighter. And they were at the launch with us this morning. And Bruce, it's cognizant to the fact that the future of South Africa is young. The future of South Africa is bright. And there's so much hope and so much light. And what we need to do is play our part and play our role in supporting small business.
How does this have any opportunity to go beyond a 3-month trial? I mean, is this a serious trial that says, if this works, if you get the sales, if you see that you move volume, that this could be extended not only beyond the 3 months, but beyond just these 12 brands?
Absolutely. And Bruce, as you know, there's an old saying, you give a man to fish and you feed him for a day, you teach him to fish and you feed him for a lifetime. We're trialing this. We've selected the stores, as you said. We want the customers to give us feedback on what they're feeling. We're going to talk to our store managers. We're going to talk to everybody that we can speak to and say, of course, we want to extend this. We want to put our brand behind any small business out there in South Africa. We want to say, wherever we are, wherever we operate in the communities that we serve, we want to back you.
And what sort of deals have these guys got with you now? Have they got to do big production to get into your supply chain? Are they geared up for it? Are they ready for it? And what happens to these guys at the end of this 3-month period? Is it, we throw you in the deep end. If you swim, that's great. If you can't tread water, we'll throw you out at the end of the 3-month period. You're not a charity after all.
Absolutely not. But I just want to clarify, the Meet the Maker, the 12 entrepreneurs or 12 businesses that are doing this are already part of our enterprise and supplier development program.
Okay.
A lot of them have been in the program for a minimum of 3 years, a maximum of about 10 years. And like I said, we're taking them through a journey. What we've done is we've invested in a lot of marketing material for them. That means that when you go into any of these trial stores, you'll be able to see the product. You'd be able to add some of the product is in front of the store. And absolutely not, Bruce, I must emphasize, it's not about when something doesn't work, we've got to look at how we can fix it. But I am very, very optimistic, and I'm positive that our customers will go out there. And what it will do is really be the front and fore of saying, how do we back these guys? And I'm hoping the whole of South Africa and anyone listening out there, go to your nearest Pick and Pay, and hopefully it's in one of our trial stores, and just take a look. And support.
Are there
local
stores in Cape Town and Joburg? That's where we broadcast, Cape Town and Joburg, both stores in both cities?
Absolutely. So we have stores, if I may mention which store that we're trialing. It's both in Cape Town. We've got a store in Durban, Ferry Glen, we're in Norwood, Sea Point, Wynberg in Cape Town, Waterfront, Claremont, and Brackenfell, Haifa.
Okay, in Joburg?
In Joburg, we're in Norwood, in Joburg, in
okay.
Norwood, Haifa.
Right. Okay, just in the Norwood Hyper in Joburg. But thanks for the list as well. Mashinga Kombo, thank you. It's great to see. It really is. And Tina Mazia, co-founder at Very Green. Just small businesses getting a break. Our big break feature. We're doing that again on Wednesday. If you haven't entered our big break, the Money Show Big Break, we're looking to give big breaks to people who need them. And we'd be delighted if you were one of those people. Go to our website, 702.co.za or capetalk.co.za. You'll find the form on the Money Show page. And if you're somebody who can give a big break to somebody who needs it, then we'd like you to fill in the form and say, look, hey, I can provide some marketing services, or I can provide this, or I can provide that. And you'll get to meet some new and interesting people, certainly people who are operating in a very different environment, perhaps, to what you are doing at the moment.
The Money Show. Business Books.
So Business Books tonight, we're looking at a book that says there is a formula, the science behind whether people fail or succeed. And you've got to ask yourself the question, why do some people succeed and some people fail? We all went to school with the kids who were going to succeed no matter what. Some of them who looked like they would crash and burn have gone on to orbit and they've done so brilliantly. And then, of course, there are those that peaked too early and have not succeeded to what to the extent that you might have thought. So what does make some people succeed and others fail? Apparently, there is a science to it. Albert Laszlo Barabasi is the author of The Formula, the science behind why people succeed or fail. He's on the line to us from Boston in the United States, where he teaches at university. Prof, is there a secret sauce in the success formula?
There is actually one, but it's not a single one, because it depends on where you are within your career, what your goals are, and what's your attitude of success, of how would you use that.
Oh, I mean, okay, define success. Maybe we could start there. My expectation of what makes a successful person is probably very different from yours and different from everybody else who's listening to us this evening.
I am so glad that you started there. Because indeed, in our mind, people actually kind of confuse the concept of performance and success. That is that, you know, we go to school, we exercise, we practice so that we increase performance, and we believe that automatically that will translate into success. In our research, which is very data-based research, we try to distinguish very clearly the performance from success. Performance is what you do, how fast you run, what kind of shows you run, what kind of paintings you paint, what theorems you prove. It's all tacked to you, your actions. Success, however, is about what does the community sees, acknowledges of your actions, and how does it reward you for those. In other terms, your performance is about you, but your success is about us. Success is a collective measure that captures the community's reaction to your performance.
Okay, let me ask you an impossible question. Who is more successful, Jeff Bezos or Mother Teresa?
Well, I'm really glad that you asked that because, you know, what I hear you say is that does fame really matter? Because these are very famous people. And, and you know, is fame one of the measures of success? And it is one of them, but it's not the only one. And neither money is the other one, right? Each area has a different measure of success. If you are a businessman, it could be the businesses you build, eventually the money those businesses make. If you are, however, a writer, it's really the readership and kind of their attitude towards your book. If you are a scientist, your measure of success could actually be the impact you make in science measured in citations. So it could be citations, could be money, could be listeners for musicians and things like that. And one of the many different dimensions is actually fame and visibility. And these are all valid measures of success. And the laws of success that I describe in the formula apply to each of them because these are all collective measures of success. It's not something that you do, but something we give to you. We cite your work. We know you. We pay you for your services. And therefore, we as a community give you that success in return.
It's about networks, and it's the network that determines your success, whether it was the network of the impoverished in Delhi at the time that Mother Teresa was working and she was improving lives, or whether it be the network of people sitting at home waiting for Jeff Bezos to deliver their shoes or whatever it might be.
You are absolutely right. And networks are very important. And, you know, this, you're talking to my soul here because I'm a network scientist and I came to this actually from that perspective. what our research showed is that networks are important only in one case. And to understand that case, let's step back a little bit and talk about it. You know, when does performance lead to success? If you are a runner, you have a one-dimensional measure of performance, how fast you run. And me having a chronometer, I can very accurately gauge your performance. And what our research shows is that when performance is accurately measurable, it uniquely determines your success. However, most of us are in professions where it's very difficult to measure our performance. You know, like, how can you really quantify your performance as a talk show host that is divorced from your from the readership, right, or how many people listen to you? How can you really tell how good you am I as a scientist, and so on? So most of us live in professions where we don't have a chronometer to measure our performance. And the most extreme situation, that would be art. When I look at the cup of water in front of me here in my office, this could be simply a cup of water, which it is, but could be a very variable artwork if it's actually exhibited in a major museum. So what I try to say is that there are lots of areas where performance is inherently impossible to measure. And in those cases, what our research shows is that the networks determine success. That is, and the most extreme example that is indeed in arts, which is we studied and I discussed in the formula, where we showed that the network between institutions, meaning galleries and museums, and your position in that network, that where were you exhibited before, uniquely determines the valuation of your work as well as your future success as an artist. So indeed, this is really the first law of the formula saying performance does drive success. But when performance cannot be measured, it's networks that drive success.
Laszlo Barabasi, thank you. The formula, the universal laws of success, why people succeed or fail. It's absolutely fascinating. It really is. And then try and apply it to people you know, and then tell them that you've tested them, you've judged them, and either you're terribly impressed or you found them wanting. It'll freak them out. It'll be brilliant.
The Money Show is brought to you by NetBank. Looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently. NetBank. The Money Show. Make Money Mondays.
Tonight's Make Money Monday special edition guest would have woken you up for years. How long? How many years?
I was what? Working or not?
Waking you up in the morning.
Oh, waking up was a very long time. Radio, then TV. It was probably about 15 years in total.
She woke you up for 15 years. You should resent her. Her name is Tracy Going. You would know that from her voice, and you would know her face from many TV shows that she's done, but she's worked across news and business and lifestyle and media. Most recently, she wrote her memoir, Brutal Legacy, about surviving abuse. And it's not just abuse in a relationship in, as an adult, but it's abuse that goes back a very long time. She's with us in studio this evening. You've had a hell of a ride, Jessica.
Well, no, not really. I think when you condense anything into one short book, it probably sounds a lot worse.
A hell of a ride in a short book.
That's right. Well, I mean, I'm sitting here opposite you, completely empowered, and have been for a long time. You know, so I was finally able to actually share the story because I am coming from a position of strength, really.
No, but I mean, it's people are shaped by their experiences. People are shaped by the lives that they live. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Brits, which is outside of Pretoria, on a small holding.
Like so many people do and did. Back in those days, and Dad was a member of the local golf club.
Well, I'm not even sure if he really was a member. He didn't play.
He spent a lot of time there.
He spent a lot of time there. I don't ever recall him playing golf, but he certainly supported them on a completely different level. The 19th hole, he was there.
Yeah. And that was, I mean, your early experience of having to survive in a tough environment.
Well, I mean, you know, that was where he found comfort in the bottle at the golf club. And the golf club was actually right behind us. You could actually climb through the barbed wire fence and walk over all the holes and get to the golf club. That's not the way he got there, but we as children used to.
He used to drive because he was a responsible.
He would drive. He would drive the tarred road going there and then take the dust road coming back because, you know, he knew. But we used to climb through the barbed wire fence and go and play golf ourselves. So that was great.
But growing up in Brits in a different decade to now, and we're give anything away. Let's not give away too much. What do your mom and dad do? I mean, what were their occupations?
My father was quite a smart man on many levels, and I think that was, I always have this thing about, you know, people sort of tipping over into madness, and I prefer to think of him as that way. My father was an entrepreneur and was always starting up businesses, and then they would fail and then he would start them up again. And I think what really, I think he almost self-destructed and would turn to the bottle. And that would be the end of really any business venture. And I think what happens in very often a situation like that is the wife, my mother, that would then step in and try and keep it all together.
Which happens so often in families.
It
certainly does. But I mean, so money wasn't certain, income was volatile, there were good times, no doubt.
And there were good times.
Euphoric times.
There were, you know, there was times where we had a lot and there were times where we had nothing. And I think, and that certainly you were saying in the introduction, you know, that that defines the way we go forward and the way we treat, you know, we handle finances. And it certainly affected me. And I remember as a small girl really working out that that if you're financially dependent on someone, your choices are limited. And I made that decision as a small girl that I would not be financially dependent on anyone, and I would never, I would always be able to choose what situation I was in. And it certainly driven me all the way through my life.
And I mean, so growing up, I mean, did sort of your dad control the purse strings, or did mom, what she had, control purse strings?
Yeah,
how was that divvied up?
She certainly tried, and she certainly, had to buffer where she could, and she worked exceptionally hard. I mean, my mother was a school teacher, and I remember her getting up very early in the morning to bake for the local Tess Neighbourhood, you know, trying to beef up the, you know, what was available in the home because of what was happening and how everything was falling apart. But that's just the way it goes.
So. Yeah. And then growing up, I mean, were you always in media? Did you sort of...
I always knew I wanted to be on television.
And it was so brand new and shiny.
It was so new, and I used to watch all that. Now I'm really giving my age away. No, I'm not going to mention names. So who I used to watch and...
Who did you used to watch?
Dorian Berry.
Dorian Berry. Everybody watched Dorian Berry.
I did. And Anne Williams.
Oh, Anne Williams.
And watched them and thought, one day I'm going to be there. I had to get out of Brits.
You had to get out. How did you get out of Brits? What was your escape route?
It was a varsity, and I was never going to go back.
They're small towns. been there, done
some
that,
people love
escaped it.
And it's a beautiful way of life. And I mean, we all escape. We escaped a city, and then we dream to have, you know,
to escape back to the small town. Yes, we do. But what did you study at university then? Did you go to Rhodes?
No. I was at Wits for the obligatory sort of 1 year, and then I went on to qualify in fashion design, actually.
Why?
It was wonderful. It's creative.
Do you do fashion design now?
No, I have very little interest in fashion, actually. But
at the time, though, what was the? Well, I mean, you wanted to be on TV, but then you went into fashion design.
I did, and it was fabulous. It was short lived, but it was lovely.
And did you work in fashion, or did you just do the study?
I actually did quite a successful evening range that was bought over by a boutique at that time. And in fact, I remember being on TV, being interviewed about it. And it was a wonderful time. And I studied at an academy where we actually, with a guy called Gordon Flack Davison, and he was very aligned to the Miss South Africa, and we used to dress the Miss South Africa finalists. And so it was awfully glamorous.
It was showbiz.
So it was my first foray into that. And then, but I was determined TV was where I wanted to be.
How did you crack that nod?
I started in production, really, producing music videos behind the scenes, and then got to know the whole music industry, and one of the DJs presenting a music show said to me one day, "Don't you want to come and read news for me on radio?" And that's where it started.
Who was that?
Lawrence Dubé.
Lawrence Dubé gave you your break.
He did.
Hey, how cool is that? And that was a Metro.
That's it. And he called me in to read the news, and the station manager knew nothing about it, and he came, you know, sort of coming, hurling down 8 floors to get to the studio underground and, you know, to see who was reading
the
news on
his station. You were in the SABC in the basement, yes.
Yeah, and then he sort of looked at me and he introduced himself. He said, "I'm the station manager." I said, "Oh," and he said, "Would you like to join us?" And that was the start of my career.
It looked great. Here's your audition live on air. Well, you've got to take your chances.
The station manager didn't know anything about, so,
But yeah, there's a story like that here with a guy called Jeremy Mansfield one day. But anyway, that's another story altogether.
The times have changed.
They have. Oh, yeah. Now it's all like their forms and stuff. It's very boring. It really is boring. But did you, I mean, and once you were in the SABC machine in those days, you get the networks. You start finding out what's going on. You find out where the auditions are.
Well, that's it. You know, people say to you, "Don't you want to come and do a voiceover?" And that was where it started. And then And somehow the next thing you're on TV. So
not somehow the next thing you're on TV. It doesn't just happen like that.
No, what I've done over the years is I've done a lot of training in the industry, and I've realized that those who really want to be on TV or want to be in the media and are determined to get there, they actually do get there. So it really depends on how much you want it.
There's only one rule.
What is that?
Never say no to anything. I remember when Mandy Wiener was much, much younger. She was doing traffic reports on the radio. And traffic is an absolutely crucial part of everything we do. And she said, I've been asked to do this. I said, well, go and do it then. But my shift is over. And I said, no, it's not. Carry on. And she still hasn't forgiven me to this day. One day when there's the book, I'll be in trouble over that. But it is that thing of thrusting yourself into the line of fire.
You always got to take a chance.
You do. And you were on our television screens and on our radios for an awfully long time. Then you disappeared.
I disappeared. I made a choice. I was pregnant with my third child, and I decided that my eldest child was going into high school, and he had never woken up with his mother in the house.
Mandy Wiener, I can hear you. Thank you, Mandy. Hello, Mandy.
Hello, Mandy.
We were right. Never woken up with his mother in the house, yes.
Yeah, and I decided that was it. Third child, and they were now going to have me there in the mornings.
No, and it's critical. I mean, it's again a choice that many women feel they have to make, where fathers may not feel the same level of obligation.
No, some do.
Which is lovely, but it tends to, at the risk of being sexist, it's difficult to manage it all.
It really is. There does come a time where you can or want to make that decision, perhaps. Look, I still, there's still a part of me that sort of thinks, well, you know, maybe was it really the right decision? Because it's wonderful to have a career as a woman, but it's very difficult to have it all.
But you've been teaching. I mean, you've been teaching at the film school, and you've been writing books. Not only did you write your biography, but you've also done very well in writing kids' story cookbooks.
Oh, that was such a fun initiative.
With small kids in the house, suddenly you've got that motivation, haven't you?
It actually ended up becoming a bestseller, and I think we sold about 9,000 copies of the first book. And it really, I'm actually embarrassed about the book, I must tell you. To be perfectly honest, it was really badly written. I didn't know so at the time. I knew nothing about books or publishing or anything. I just had little children. I was forever going to birthday parties, buying gifts, and I thought, well, that's it. I must buy... I'm going to write my own cookbook. Oh, no, I went to the shop. I wanted to go and buy cookbooks as gifts and couldn't find anything I liked. And I came home and I started writing my own cookbook. And I'd watched Oprah once, and she'd said, you know, if you're not certain what to do in life, you must think about what you enjoy. And I thought, oh, well, I love cooking, and I love reading, and I love poetry, and I love this. I'll just put it all together in one book, which I did. But I'm actually embarrassed because it really was badly written. I can't believe it was really published.
But you did do well out of the second one. I mean, the second one of Poncy Food World in France, you got a big prize.
Yes, it came second in the world.
You see?
At the Gourmand Cookbook Fair, at the Paris Cookbook Fair, second in the world. Best children's cookbook or something. Yes. But then I never sort of pursued it here, back at home, and let it go.
And since then, lots of kids cooking TV shows and all of that sort of stuff, and it's become very commercialized via the cooking channels on TV, which is a new genre, of course, as we've seen. Growing up in media and working in media, you would have done lots of performances and you would have done lots of appearances, and so you would have...
I can see where this is going.
No, but you would have done well outside of your TV, your media earnings. Let's be honest about it and say they're not very good.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, we were at studio. I was at work at Hoppers 4 every morning. I felt I deserved to be paid well for it. And I think I've always believed in sort of if I'm going to do the job, then I want to be paid fairly for it. And it was a fabulous time, and it was quite something to walk away from all of that. But even then, I understand the media and the broadcasting side of things, and I know that stars shine brightly, and then they die out, they're gone. So I always knew that I had to make provision for tomorrow. So it wasn't just.
So did you start early? Were you a good and responsible saving student, based on the lessons of your childhood sitting in Brits?
Well, that's it. You know, I was always going to be able to make my own choices, and I did. I invested in property. I renovated, I sold, I love working with space. I'm doing it again right now. So I've always made sure that I had various sources of income. and made it fun.
Sources of income is different to building wealth or building security. Let's talk about security rather. Mm-hmm. Did you build that security or were you having fun?
I did, because I can still make choices. But I mean, obviously when I walked away from a career, which is something that many women do, or even just from a job, you know, obviously you're financially compromised, and I was quite strategic about it because I knew going forward how much I'd be giving up. So I actually negotiated a financial agreement with my husband at the time. We agreed that we both wanted me to stop working full time in the, you know, the way I was working, because I would be away for 10 nights a month, and it was just too much having three kids in the house. So it wasn't fair on anyone. And then, of course, you know, doing early morning shows, you've got to be in bed by 9 o'clock because you're up so early. So it isn't a life. No, it isn't a life. So, so we struck an agreement right up front. I was never going to lose my ability to pay for my retirement annuities, my investment portfolio, whatever it needed to be serviced.
To be sustained,
And that was the agreement I made, because I know that so often, very often, women are left on the back foot.
But you go and you're in a relationship and you make an agreement, and that's fine, but there's no financial part to that agreement. Then the relationship doesn't work out.
Absolutely.
And suddenly
everything falls apart.
Hold on a second.
And then you turn around and you say, well, you know, what about me as a woman? And he says, well, I paid the bond, I paid the car, they're assets, they're mine. And of course, what have you done with her salary? You've eaten it, you've consumed it.
Yeah.
The kids have worn the shoes, you know, they're long gone, the food's been eaten, and you're left with nothing. And I wanted to make sure that didn't happen to me. I think, obviously, you're still going to be compromised, but...
But you went in with your eyes wide open, and perhaps that's the little girl growing up. In Brits, and you go, hold on, I don't want to be in my mom's situation where your mom may not have had the choices that you had.
Yeah. And I mean, my mother is very successful. She's a very well respected businesswoman, in her community. So, and that's fabulous. And I think, I often believe, Bruce, I don't know, I might be shot down for this, but, I believe we very often inherit our work ethic from our mothers. I don't know why I think that. And I've always thought that. And I think maybe it was because my mother always was such a good example to me.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps that's why I think that. So as a mother, I've always wanted my children to see me as someone who is a working mother, contributing on some other level, not just hanging out in coffee shops and having a good time.
There's something to be said for that. No, there's something to be said for coffee shops. Coffee shops are good places. No. But it is about examples. And you either have positive role models or negative role models, and those have a big influence. When you made your first investments, those property investments, or when you built up an investment portfolio, what was the first one where you went, this is big?
I don't know if there was ever anything big.
But big is relative. I mean,
When I bought my second property, which was a property at the Hartbeespoort Dam, so it was sort of a weekend place.
One of those.
So I had my primary residence, and then I suddenly had this weekend place, and I was 25 years old. So I still sort of look back on that as one of my achievements.
And do you still have the place in Hartbeespoort?
No, I mean, she sold it to move on, but...
Yeah, no, exactly.
But it was great.
When you looked at those investments, I mean, and going in and starting retirement annuities and share portfolios and things like that, because you've implied that you have done it.
Yes.
Have you done it yourself?
Let me not overplay it, though. I'm not...
Mrs. Rockefeller, how did you do it?
I remember thinking, as a 20-year-old, I thought, I'm going to see how the rich do it. And I'm going to see what they do. And I'd speak to people, and they, you know, would tell me things like, don't over-insure your car when it isn't the value of the car. Don't waste money. And I think I've always been very frugal when it comes to, I don't have a big wardrobe. I loathe spending. To me, it's wasting money buying clothes and things like that. So I've always been very frugal. I think I've lost track of your question, though.
No, so have I. It's fine. You can go a far more interesting path. But with that idea of wasting money, the idea that there are people who simply pay for insurance policies for year after year after year, and it's a bit too much hassle. I'm actually a bit embarrassed to admit they don't understand what they've got, and a bit embarrassed to go, can somebody help me with this? And so often when you don't review this stuff, you work out that you're actually spending possibly tens of thousands of rand a year more than you need to spend.
And also those things are always being upgraded, so different policy packages are coming out or whatever, and I think you do...
The industry is innovating
again,
all the time.
You see, you worded so much better than me. Bruce, are you in finance?
I'm not in finance, but I do talk about it, yes. There's a difference.
But yeah, I think that... So I think certainly, even if you know nothing, you know, every couple of years, get hold of your broker and say, listen, just tell me what's going on, you know, and just have a look at it.
You can do that too. When you were talking about two rich people about how to become rich,
I should read the newspapers.
Richer, would you read the newspapers?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you wouldn't actually talk. You didn't have any mentors in those days.
No, I was presenting business news at one point a long time ago, and it was interesting. You know, because rich people got there because they're clever. They're clever with money.
Mm-hmm. They are. And they understand the way it works, and it's the tool that makes the difference. What's been your best money decision ever?
Yeah, I think I remember buying a property and subdividing it and making a fair amount on that. And that was probably...
Whereabouts was that?
That was in Johannesburg.
Whereabouts?
Was probably in one of the parks.
Which park?
The park, Craigall Park.
Craigall Park. I mean, Craigall Park used to be full of 1,800 square meter properties, and now it's full of 900 square meter properties.
That
yes.
was it, you know. So it was, that was pretty smart then. And also, what I'd done then was, do you remember when interest rates just went through the roof? And
98.
I had capped all of mine.
You had. Now, you see, I'm so torn on this, because by capping an interest rate, you pay for, while interest rates are lower, you pay a higher rate. Mm. But in South Africa, at a time where inflation was mad and where we didn't have inflation targeting and where these things were more open to manipulation than they are now, it was a very smart thing to do. Would you cap interest rates today?
No, I don't. I actually don't. But
the environment is a fundamentally different place to what it was then.
But then it was huge, the difference between the way where I'd capped and where it eventually ended up.
Well, interest rates went to 25%.
Well, that's exactly. And I had capped considerably lower. And at that point, I had four properties. So it was...
It would have killed you.
It would have completely wiped me out. And this, in fact, probably was the turning point for me. I mean, I'm not sitting here as a wealthy woman. I'm just saying I'm sitting here as somebody who is careful. And at my age, you don't take risks. Well, I feel that I shouldn't take risks.
But the point is, you've been... responsible. You have taken risk during your time, and you've mitigated your risk during that time as well.
And very much my mantra is, it's not always what you earn, it's what you spend.
Yes, absolutely. Oh, it happens so fast. Mm. It's so metal. It comes in so slowly and goes out so fast.
Well, I mean,
where does
everything, the cost of living has escalated. I mean, if I look at the way I spend money now compared to 5 years ago, you're literally only buying food.
Mm.
It's a shame the way things have escalated.
We do need some growth, and we do need some zing. We've had some zoom. That didn't work out well. We need some zing in the economy. Do you have any bad money habits? I mean, do you like a good bottle of wine? Or do you spend money on books?
No. Oh, no, I'd rather the cheapest one. Oh, no, that's a waste of money. but I will buy a very good pair of shoes, but I will keep them for years and years and years.
But they have to be good in order for that.
They have to be good, and when I take them off, they go at the top of the cupboard or the top of the table or wherever. They get prime position in the house, and they are looked after.
Artwork. See, we haven't spent money on a painting, but these shoes with these red soles. What's the most you've ever spent on a pair of shoes?
No, I'm not telling you.
What's the most expensive brand of shoe you've ever bought?
Gucci.
What do Gucci shoes go for? She's not telling. Her name is Tracy Going. She is a former big star of television and radio. And nowadays, you've written your book. What's next? What's next?
Actually, it's the post-book process has kept me very busy, and it's going to be a play launching
the
2nd of April in Johannesburg at the Theatre on the Square.
Fantastic.
So that's exciting. So I'm allowing myself to be available for that.
Will you watch it? Will you be able to watch it?
No, I have to watch it. I have to watch it. It's my story. I have to watch it.
Tracy Going, looking forward to it. Tracy Going, thank you very much for coming in on Make Money Mondays.